right, now we're returning now to the Talmud and the Tractate of Sanhedrin. That's page 56b. Okay. Now, we were dealing with the question of the derivation of the laws of the Ben Noach, the seven laws of the Ben Noach. And if you recall, there is that one verse in Genesis that where it says that God commanded man, and that's in the beginning of Genesis with regard to Adam, and just one second. It is Genesis 2:16. Okay. Now every word, if you remember, every word in that verse is associated with one of the seven laws. And that's a method of derivation. Now I want to mention that the methods of derivation that the scholars use does not mean, as most people think when they look at a piece of Talmud, they think that the that's where the rabbis first made the discovery of these ideas. See, that's completely an error. Just to give you an example, Maimonides points this out. And that's the difficulty with Talmud, and that's why people that are today are getting into reading Talmud. But they, if you don't know the basic principles of the Talmud, then you don't know what you're reading. For instance, the Talmud proves what an esrog is. You know, you use the four species, and it proves the word, what an esrog is, from the verse, and it proves what the what a lulav is from the verse, and the other two species, you know, the willow and the myrtle. But this, of course, does not mean that the Talmud first made the discovery of a lulav or an esrog around the year 500 or 400. I mean, that's ridiculous. That these things were used for generations before. And I think that there is even a archaeological evidence that Bar Kochva used the four species. But there's no doubt about it. The rabbis didn't just wake up one day and just discover the four species in the text. But Maimonides explains that the idea of the text, of the derivation from the text, is a concept in Talmud, which means that even though we know the law from the oral law, everybody knew what an esrog was passed down from generation to generation, still in all, there is a principle that there is nothing that we do that does not have a source in the written law itself. There has to be some kind of allusion or reference to it in the text, okay? So the reference in the text is important. First of all, the mere fact that there's nothing, that everything has to go back to the text, is a didactic tool, means learning process. But also, it's important because when you have a derivation from a text and you study the, and you study the framework of the text, concepts emerge that place the law in a certain framework. Okay, and there you can have certain arguments among the scholars. So the allusion to the text is not a discovery of the commandment, but it has importance in terms of gaining knowledge about the framework and the concepts of the text. We're going to see how that works tonight. So just to make it clear once again, the rabbis knew about the seven laws of Noah. They are not over here trying to discover them from the text like most people who just don't know anything about Talmud think. You can't take that verse and just discover the seven laws of Noah. It's pretty obvious. But what it does mean is the seven laws of Noah were known and were part of the oral law, and basically the seven laws of Noah is an oral tradition. It's not in the text. But again, because of the fact that there must be an allusion in the text to the law, the rabbis say that that one verse stands out because if you break down that verse into components, you'll see every component happens to be associated with one of the seven laws via semantic association, and it's pretty clear. So the rabbis of the Talmud were saying, there was a group of rabbis, group of scholars that were convinced that the fact that that particular verse breaks down into seven components that are semantically associated with the seven laws, that could not have been a coincidence, but that was actually intended by God when he wrote the Torah, and that is where the allusion in the text is. Now, again, if the rabbis couldn't find an allusion in the text, that wouldn't mean there are no seven laws of Noah. The seven laws of Noah are known essentially through the oral law. But the rabbis always search for the text because it's important, first of all, as a point of knowledge, to know which text it is. And secondly, when you know the text, we can gain a lot of information from the framework of the text. And from the method of derivation, we can deduce concepts and also laws, further laws. Okay? As you know, when we say seven laws, it means seven basic entities. There are many, many laws under the seven laws. Okay. So there is an argument among the scholars as to which text you derive the seven laws from. Essentially, it's two groups, essentially. One group maintains it's from this verse in Genesis 2:16, which means it was a commandment to Adam. The second group, we'll come to later at the end of the page, deduces it from the flood, from the incident with God's speaking with Noah after the flood. Okay. The difference, of course, is were the seven laws incumbent upon Adam? Did Adam the first man, did he actually receive these seven laws, or were they something that resulted later in other words, when the societal corruption took place, then God mandated these seven laws? But actually, before that time, Adam didn't keep the seven laws, but it means to say that they weren't officially formulated until the time of Noah. That's the question. Was the formulation given to Adam himself, or was the formulation actually didn't take place until after the flood? That is the debate between the rabbis. Two groups there. Okay, let's just keep that in mind. Now, the question, of course, you may ask is, why is it that the Torah did not see fit to openly list the seven laws of Noah? Just like you have the Ten Commandments, or you have so many other laws in the Torah. Why couldn't the Torah see fit to actually openly state these seven laws? Now, the reason for that has to do not with the importance or unimportance of the seven laws. I want to make this clear. If a law is not written openly in the Torah, it does not make it any less important. All right? The reason why things are not written in the Torah has nothing to do with importance, but there are different considerations. The gaps, many times you have gaps in the Torah. As Rabbi Soloveitchik says, some of the gaps are striking in the Torah. For instance, in last week's portion of the Torah, we read about the slavery, the enslavement of the Jewish people in Egypt. Okay, we started the book of Exodus. Now, nowhere in the Torah does it really describe how this process took place. It's pretty abrupt. First, you go from Joseph being the second to the king in Egypt, and then suddenly the Torah goes into slavery. It does not explain what happened. What was this process? Obviously, something must have happened. Okay. The Torah is very brief over there, just very abrupt. The reasons for the slavery, in order to understand that, you have to really read between the lines. But I want to give you one principle, and the principle is as follows, that whenever the Torah omits something, it is because there are two vehicles of communication that we have from Sinai. One vehicle was the written word, okay, and the second vehicle is the interpretations and the of the commandments and the Torah that Moses received at the same time. So certain things are not fit. God saw certain things not to be fit for transmission through the written medium, okay? Now, there are many considerations as to why this is so, but again, it is not because of the importance or unimportance of the law. Now, one of the considerations in general is the nature of the material. In general, material that is more abstract and more theoretical, the Torah does not communicate through the written law. All right, because the written law is something which everyone is supposed to be able to read and to have access to, not necessarily a great mind or a great scholar. When you get to the abstract, fine points of Torah, the points that require great intelligence and great intellectual energy and work and pondering, that is not in the not communicated through the vehicle of the written law, but that's always communicated through the vehicle of the oral law, because
Rabbi,
theoretics. Okay.
Question.
Yeah.
Where would you go to? So you're talking a lot about the oral law, and the question I'm about to ask is kind of a 101 question. But where would you go in the Torah if someone asked you to show them the oral law? Where does it talk about the oral law?
Okay.
Not just about the Sheva Mitzvot, but the oral law itself.
Okay.
Because and let me give another one, because in light of this, it appears that in the text of Torah, the Torah talks about not adding to nor taking away from the words, you know, Deuteronomy 4:12 and these others.
Right.
So they would say, why would you put emphasis on the written, the oral Torah and not the written Torah? Now, I know the examples that you've given in the past about the mezuzah, the tzitzit, and these type of things, but is there, what I'm asking for is a specific quote or a specific situation that is clear that it's referring to the oral tradition.
Okay. The Torah clearly states the oral tradition. There is no, I know a lot of people just aren't aware of it, but it is clearly stated in the Torah, couldn't be stated any more clearly, that there is an oral law. Okay. The statement is in Deuteronomy 17:8. Okay. It says, if something be too perplexing to you, I don't know your translation, I'm giving you my translation, if something is too perplexing for you in judgment, whether it's a matter of blood from blood to blood, law to law, whether it's a matter of a plague to a plague, in other words, whether it's a matter of any one of these things. Now, blood has to do with that has to do with the area of menstruation. There's different types of blood. Certain menstrual blood makes the woman unclean, to use a poor translation. That's the area of dam. Then you have the area of blood. Then you have the area of din, which has to do with judgments. Okay. Then you have the area of when you have a leprosy. It's not called a plague. It's called I don't know the exact translation in English. It means there's, you know, the in Leviticus you have extensive account of what exactly if in a garment there is a kind of a change of color on a person, the plagues of the flesh and of the house and of the garments. Okay, like the leprosy. That's what that means. And then it says also whether you have an argument in your gates. The gates mean the place where the wise men discuss the law. All right? So here you see the Torah speaking about difficulties in understanding what the Torah means. Obviously, if everything is written out, there's nothing to understand, then you're not going to have any difficulties. So it says, then you shall arise and go up to the place where God has chosen, and that's because the Sanhedrin is in the temple itself. And then it says, you shall come to the Kohanim, the Levites, and the judges that are in that day, that exist in that time, and you shall search, ask them, in other words, and they will tell you what the judgment is. In other words, when you look, God is saying, when you look at this book, you're going to have problems, because there are going to be many things that you don't understand that are not spelled out here. And what you shall do is, if there are arguments among the scholars in the local courts even, then they have to go to the Supreme Court of the land, which is the Sanhedrin of 71, that is in the place that God chose, which means in Jerusalem, in the temple. And then verse 10 says, you shall do according to the thing that they tell you from that place that God shall choose, and you shall be careful and do everything that they teach you. There's the word Torah, that they teach you. And then it says, according to the Torah that they teach you, and according to the judgment which they say to you, you shall do. You shall not veer from the thing, stray from the thing which they tell you, to the right or to the left. And then the next verse says, anyone that does not abide by what the Sanhedrin says, what the judges say, that person shall be put to death. Okay? So the Torah is quite clear that that it is not a self-explanatory document, and that you must go to the scholars of Israel who will interpret the law for you, and you must follow their interpretation exactly. As a matter of fact, it says, according to the Torah that they teach you, that's the Torah that you must follow. Which means to say that the written law is by definition incomplete. This could be seen also from Exodus with Moses and Jethro. When Jethro made the suggestion, he saw that Moses was getting exhausted from answering questions, so he had Moses set up a hierarchy. And then there again, it mentions in Exodus that they came on matters of judgment. Now, obviously, the written law does not suffice to answer the questions. So it is pretty clear from Exodus, and it's open in Deuteronomy, that there is an oral system of interpretation of the law. Now, this is really clear to any intelligent person who reads the Bible and sees that you cannot understand the Bible without the oral explanation. God would not give people a book that just doesn't work. So it's clear by way of induction, and it's clear by way of deduction, I mean, so you can deduce from the Torah itself that it has to have an oral system, and it's open in the Torah in Deuteronomy 17. I mean, you have to be pretty blind not to see it in these verses. So the concept of the oral law is very clear. Torah says specifically that you are bound by the scholars of Israel, the Sanhedrin, the judges of Israel, and according to the Torah that they teach you, which is the oral law. Okay. I know that's something which, I'll tell you.
All right, Rabbi?
Yes.
I'm playing the devil's advocate because I've had several people just in the last week that have asked me specific questions about the oral law.
Yes.
And so you're answering them, and I think it's important because they ask, well, if I teach someone the seven laws of Noah, so where is that in the Bible?
Right.
And so I know this is elementary, but I think we need to go back with it again. Now, the next question that I was asked is this. All right, I can agree with what you're saying here, but you're talking about the Levites and the Sanhedrin.
Right.
All right, the rabbis are not mentioned here. Now, I wouldn't have a problem that if I were going to a Sanhedrin and the Levites and they are interpreting and they're giving halakhic rulings, that's fine, but to go to a rabbi today, which rabbi do I go to? Which one can give halakhic rulings in these areas? And who put them in charge? Because the text clearly speaks of the Levites and the people that Moses set, in other words, the 70 that were to carry on. So is this a good question?
That's a good question.
All right, thank you.
That's a good question. The answer to that question is that one from the time that after the time that we lost the, you see, the Sanhedrin means those who have the smicha. Okay, that's what makes them members of the Sanhedrin. Now, after we lost the smicha, that's after the closing of the Talmud. So it is true that after the Talmud was closed, the end of the Talmud, that was the end of the smicha, then there is no official ruling. That you're absolutely correct. But all rulings up to that time are 100% official because it was done by people that were authorized through the process of smicha that went back to Moses. Okay? So that means up to and through the conclusion of the Talmud. Now, after that point, we are bound by the entire ruling of the Talmud, okay, which is rather extensive, in case there is a question, and there are many questions, that you don't have the, you have arguments, arguments among the scholars of the Talmudic scholars that followed the Talmud, okay, so then you are correct. There is no real official ruling. There is no official ruling. And, however, there are certain principles that we follow. And those are principles that are based upon methods of...
Rabbi?
Yes.
The we follow, is that B'nai Noach or B'nai Israel?
Both.
Both, okay.
Both follow that. And what we do is... We try, it makes things very difficult, because that means whenever you have an argument, you go to the side that is more severe. Whereas when you have the Sanhedrin, they could really make it easier. Because whenever you don't know, you're going to have to go to the more severe possibility. Okay? So the system then takes a turn, a turn towards the more difficult. Because let's say you have a problem today, okay? And you don't, now the problem, any problem that you have, 99% of the time, is always going to be mentioned somewhere. Now you're going to have a dispute of opinions. So since there is no official ruling process anymore, because we do not have the Sanhedrin, you're going to have to go to the side that's more severe. You can't take any chances, which makes it very difficult. And that's why a lot of laws that we keep today are very extensive, because of the fact that we don't have a right. You see, the Sanhedrin was a great thing, because if you don't know, so then you can't do it. But the Sanhedrin come along and say, no, it's permissible. So what it does is it makes you keep all the rulings of the Talmud, plus anytime you're in doubt, if you have a dispute, you can't resolve the dispute anymore, so you have to go to the side that's more severe, to the safe side, in other words. Now, whenever you go to the safe side, it means there's another prohibition that you're going to have to be involved in, which you might not have been involved in had the Sanhedrin been here, and they may have ruled that it's okay. So what it does is it makes the keeping of the system much more difficult, and that's the way it is today. The only thing we don't do is that occasionally, if you have a dispute among scholars, so again, I said you have to go to the safe side if it is a Torah law. By the way, a rabbinical law, you go to the easy side, because the rabbis, when they made their law, they always made it that if there's a doubt about it, you can go to the easy side. But the Torah law, you must always go to the safe side, because it's God's law, and you can't be in chance of violation. So the only thing that we do have is that if there is an opinion that is very extensive among the scholars, okay, and you only have a rare individual that holds it's prohibited, even though he's a scholar, we say you're not obligated to follow that side and to go to the safe side. Because we say there's such a thing as a preponderance of scholars, like let's say 99% of the scholars say it's okay, and one says he thinks it's prohibited. So in such a case, we say that your obligation is not to, you follow the vast majority, and you don't have to be concerned about the the minor opinion. But it's not the same concept as a vote in the Sanhedrin. I want you to understand that. It's not the same concept. The vote in the Sanhedrin is final, and you go by majority rule. But over here, majority is not always enough. I mean, you may have a majority of scholars, but you still, the issues, I mean, are not really necessarily resolved just because you have a majority. There may be a very valid opinion that's in the minority, but it could make a lot of sense to a specific scholar, and since there's no Sanhedrin, he has to go to the safe side even over there. I mean, Rabbi Soloveitchik's grandfather was known to always go to the safe side in many, many instances, because of the fact that even though it was a small minority that held there's a prohibition, but to his mind, that minority made a lot of sense, and there's no official ruling of the Sanhedrin. So the only thing we can do that's left after the Sanhedrin is to use our intelligence and understanding things. And if, when you're examining the issue, the Talmudic discussion, and you see all the scholars, and most of them say something's permissible, and it makes sense that way when you're studying it. You have to be a scholar, of course, to say that it makes sense. You can't just be a layman. But if to the scholar it makes sense, he has a right to say that if there's a very small minority opinion against that, he has a right to say, well, it's enough to follow the majority because we have a right to follow our minds and our intelligence, and the other opinion is really considered as if it's nil. Because it doesn't make any sense, and there aren't many authorities that uphold it. But that's a halachic method, which is not based on an official ruling, but based on the idea that Torah always is binding based upon your intelligence and your knowledge and your understanding. So that is a factor of resolving an issue through understanding. We say that this position makes most sense, most scholars hold that way, and we don't have to be concerned with a minority opinion that doesn't make sense to us. But again, it's not an official process. The official process was much more concrete, and then if you had the majority, that's it. But today we unfortunately, that's the idea, the concept of the Messiah will bring back the Sanhedrin, and then we'll have the official rulings again. And of course, that'll make things a lot easier. Okay, is that did I make the point clear? By the way, B'nai Noach are not obligated to keep any rabbinical injunctions. I want to make that clear. Rabbinical injunctions are only, rabbinical laws are only for B'nai Israel. B'nai Noach are not bound by any rabbinical laws. So it's only the Torah law. But the Torah law, they are bound by, and even if it's a doubt, if there's a dispute among the scholars, and it's not resolved in the Talmud, then the Ben Noach has to abide by that, and he has to keep both sides. He has to keep the safe side, because we have no Sanhedrin. I mean, the Ben Noach has the same problem as the Ben Israel. In his sphere, since there's no Sanhedrin, we can't resolve a lot of problems, a lot of questions. A lot of things that we're going to be studying now, you'll see, are unresolved, and the Ben Noach has to keep both sides of the argument, since the scholars of the Talmud present both positions, and both positions are valid. Kim, I'm going to add one more thing, okay?
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay, I just want to hear the following. And that is, you see, the problem with Torah is, and this is, you know, everything goes back to, somehow or other, as you already know, everything goes back to idolatry. And I want to explain something about that. I know it sounds very far removed. This conversation that we're having, this discussion we're having right now, sounds very far removed from idolatry. But really, it isn't. I'll explain to you why. You see, one of the emotions of the idolater is, what causes the person to become an idolater is not necessarily that he believes that that idol has powers. I mean, he knows the idol is just an image. But Maimonides makes this clear. They weren't stupid. People that are idolaters are not stupid people. I mean, you see today that you have millions of them, and and the mass in Rome, you'll see they have an actual physical image of a little baby, which they call they refer to that baby as God, and they bring they brought flowers there from different. Different representatives brought flowers to the baby god. I mean, now, people, when you look at it on the one hand, you say this is utterly ridiculous. And of course it is, but the people aren't just stupid. These are millions of people. The reason is because they don't believe that that particular physical image lying there in the basket is really, really has powers. To them, it's something which is symbolic of another force. Now, according to the Torah, that doesn't matter. Okay, I'm sure there are people that think that that little baby there has powers too. But even intelligent people that don't believe that, to the Torah, that is idolatry, because it means that you're trying to relate to God through something physical. You need that physical security, okay? That's a very powerful emotion in man. Man wants the physical security. But that's based on the idea that that which is physical is real. But the Torah teaches us that that's not true, that the more real is really the world of ideas. That's more real than the physical. But the primitive man is always needs something physical. Now, that expresses itself in Torah as well. When the primitive person comes to Torah, he at least wants a text. See, a text is something that's physical. You know, there it is. The words are right there, you see. But if you tell him, well, this is a very abstract discussion, and the rabbis have spent hours pondering this, and this is the conclusion, he doesn't have that sense of satisfaction. Where's that physical thing? I want to see the Word of God right here in front of me. This is what God said. There's no question about it. That is a certain need for security that man has, which is the same kind of security that the idolater needs. So the concept of the oral law, the concept of the oral law is really a concept that people have a very difficult time handling because, again, even though they may have abandoned the pagan primitive form of idolatry, but they're still looking for that security. Now, the only security that we have in Torah is God gave the system to man, and he said to man, use your intelligence, and the way your intelligence discerns it to be, that's the way it is. That's why it says, according to the Torah that they teach you, God says. It doesn't say, according to the Torah that I will teach you. God taught the Torah to Moses. That's it. Now man has to use his mind to understand it, and the way his mind understands it, that is Torah. Okay? I mentioned several times, the phylacteries that we have, it would be very, very remote possibility that Moses had the exact same phylacteries. Very, very remote. Because there's so many arguments about phylacteries that, as a matter of fact, the Gaon of Vilna used to say there are 64 different ways to have phylacteries. Okay? Now, so the question is, so how could I perform the commandment that God gave at Sinai? Moses only had one pair of phylacteries, not 64. Okay? It's not 64 pairs, actually. It's different ways of doing it. It keeps on multiplying mathematically. Like if you're standing up, sitting down, it's going to say if you have 15, standing up and sitting down is going to be 30, okay? So 64 is not really literally 64 different types of phylacteries. The arguments aren't that wide. But there are a lot of arguments, okay? When you multiply them, so they increase geometrically, and then that's why you get 64. But at any rate, regardless, my point is the following, that it does not matter. God did not tell us to wear a relic, the phylacteries that Moses wore. If we'd find Moses' phylacteries, we wouldn't get very excited. The phylacteries that the Torah tells us to wear are the phylacteries that we understand. What does the Torah say? You'll notice the Torah says in those verses I quoted to you in Deuteronomy, it says you should come to the judge that is in that day. Why does the Torah say the judge that is in that day? Of course, every judge is in that day. He has to be in the day that he lives. But what the Torah is telling you there is that you must go according to the knowledge of that day. You can't be in Moses in the knowledge of Moses. You are not in the knowledge of Moses. If you're living in the time of Rabbi Akiva, you're in the knowledge of Rabbi Akiva. If you're living in the time of Maimonides, you're in the knowledge of Maimonides. If you're living in our time, you're in the knowledge of the scholars of our day. So the Torah makes it clear that God did not give a relic over to his people. A relic would have died a long time ago, and a relic is the need for a relic is, again, an idolatrous need. You must have that physical thing. I want those phylacteries that Moses wore. That's gonna be the magic that's gonna do the trick. There's no magic that does the trick. What does the trick is living according to God's plan, and an essential in God's plan is to use your mind and your intelligence. Now, I'll tell you, I gave a class today in Talmud where they're a very unusual kind of situation, a rare kind of situation in the study of Talmud. You have a Mishnah. Now, the Mishnah has certain words in it. Now, the rabbis, there's a very, very difficult Mishnah in the Tractate of Kedushin in the last chapter. Very difficult. The rabbis of the Talmud try to work it out one way. They find that it will work out a whole thing. Looks beautiful. Uh-oh, one problem. Rejected. Then they try another approach. Didn't work. Rejected. A third approach. Didn't work. Finally, the Talmud concludes that there must be a word missing in that Mishnah. Okay? Now, that's very rare. But when we got to the way the Talmud finally explained the Mishnah, so a lot of my students started to laugh. You know, they said, "Come on, you can't fit that into the Mishnah." So I said, "Just a moment. This is an amazing thing. Why? Because actually, if you look at the Mishnah and what the rabbis are discussing, they could have fit it in very easily. They could have fit in. No one would know the difference. It would be perfect." The only reason they didn't do it was because it was not to their mind, it was not 100% theoretically sound. And at first, if you look at that, you won't even see what's wrong with it. But if you really study it for a long time, I mean hours, you will see why the theory that would be literal in the Mishnah has difficulties. So the rabbis said, rather than accept the words of the Mishnah, we are bound, according to Torah, by the proper ideas. So therefore they concluded that there must be a word missing in the Mishnah, and they followed, because that can happen, they followed the root of thought and ideas. And this is really the entire Torah. The entire Torah is to follow the world of the mind. The human mind was commanded by God to study and to understand, and we follow the results of the human mind. Now, I know, again, it's a certain insecurity there, but when you really think about it, that is the greatest security. Why? Because if Torah were dependent upon these specific things that Moses knew in his day exactly that way, without any change, you can understand the religion of Israel would not last more than a couple of generations, and that would be it. It couldn't go on, okay? There was no way, because things are lost, things happen, people move from place to place, and even scholars forget laws, and if you're going to try to keep the exact thing the way it was given at Sinai, it could not possibly last. And again, that is, the need for such a thing is an idolatrous need, looking for a relic. I want that thing, as if that thing is going to magically somehow or other save me. There's no magic that saves you. The magic that saves you is the ideas of Torah and the way of life of Torah. And God, in his infinite wisdom, saw fit to give Torah, which is a system which lasts forever, because it's based upon the scholars and with God's assistance, most of the Torah was not lost. Enough of the system, in spite of the fact that some was lost, but the bulk of the system is here. We have 613 commandments. We have an every commandment. We have the Talmudic explanations. So we may have lost a thing here or there, but not enough to destroy the system. And the system that we have, we're capable of handling questions that are not mentioned in the Talmud by using the methodology of the Talmud. The methodology and the system is the only thing that's real, and that's the only thing that can go on forever, can go on for generations and generations. People don't understand. They think that there's less security because you don't have the exact thing. That's just an emotion to have an exact thing. The security of the Torah is in the fact that it is given over to the scholars and to the world of ideas, and that's why it can be perpetuated ad infinitum. That's the real security. If you went the other way, you'd have nothing. It would be gone. So, and any intelligent person, when they think about it, they see the greatness of God's Torah in the fact that there is an oral law. Because if there wouldn't be an oral law, there would be zero. You would have nothing. And if God did not give the oral law over to the scholars of Israel, you would have absolutely zero today. It wouldn't be here. So the real security is in the world of ideas, not in the physical and not in the exact forms of the mitzvah, of the objects that were given at Sinai. Okay, and we aren't completely away from those objects. The tefillin, we know certain things for sure about tefillin, and they would look pretty much the same. But there are minor points which there are debates about, and the same thing is true with the sukkah, and the same thing is true with any commandment that we have. The important thing is God wants us to be attached to knowledge, not to objects. That's idolatrous, to be attached to objects. And the only thing that gives man salvation is involvement in God's thoughts and ideas, which are in the Torah and in the oral law. That's man's salvation. It doesn't really matter to God whether you put on this pair of tefillin or that pair of tefillin. That's not important. The important thing is you put on the tefillin that you came to the conclusion that they're correct through logical methods, through following your mind and the Torah that was received and that you received through the transmission of the tradition through all those years from the time of Moses. That's the important thing. So the important thing is to perfect a person. That's what perfects a person. A person doesn't get perfected by doing a certain action. That's a primitive idolatrous thing. If you do this and this action to the God or for the God, that you're going to be saved. That's, the Torah is all against that. Torah is a very, very sophisticated system. It's difficult because it's sophisticated, but it is God's system, and when a person understands it, they see that this is truly something which is really causes a person to become, to reach greatness and to fulfill his divine element.
Rebbe, I see you're on a roll.
I'm on a roll. Well, you told me it's important, so I had to keep going.
All right. Well, I've been waiting for you to breathe so I could jump in with another question.
Okay.
All right. Now, I've got a list of these things because these are some questions, as I said, and I want to precursor, these are some questions that I've been asked specifically in the last 2 weeks.
Right.
All right, now, there are two questions I've got to ask, and your response to one is going to precipitate another question. You said that God taught Torah to Moses.
Right.
All right, we understand that, and, you know, that's all right. But now, next week, I believe, the Parsha is Yethro. Is it next week or week after next?
Next week is Va'era, the week after is Bo, and then it's Bishan. You got a few weeks there.
Yeah, about 2 weeks, yeah.
Yeah,
all right.
A couple weeks, yeah.
Yeah, all right. But see, Yethro is the one that gave Moses the idea and told him about the Sanhedrin.
Well, yeah. It's not that simple. I mean, I could explain... I can explain that to you. If you notice, Jethro made the suggestion, but Moses, you see, Moses wasn't stupid. Why did Moses think of it? The reason, if you look carefully at those verses in the Torah where it discusses Jethro, Jethro says, one second, where's my chumash? You have chumash, Moses? Jethro says that that when he makes a suggestion, he says, God shall be with you. I'm just looking for the, I've got to get the chumash. But the point is that Moses had to have this okayed by God. Because Moses' concept was that he felt that his responsibility is to answer all the questions insofar as he himself personally is capable, because he felt that this would be more impressive upon the people. So that's why he himself judged the nation. It says from morning till evening, because he felt that perhaps God's will is that he should be personally involved, because that way, as a leader, he'll have a greater effect on the people. Now, what Jethro said was that he made a suggestion, but he said that he has to clear this with God, okay? That just give me one second. Right. So he says that the in other words, the suggestion was good, but he couldn't do it unless God agreed with it. the greatness of Jethro was that he said that you see Rashi says on he said Rashi on verse 19 where he says I will give you advice says now listen to my voice I will give you advice that's 18:19 and God shall be with you. Now what Rashi explains is it means that the advice is very good, but God has to be with you in this advice, which means to say that you must be authorized by God to do this. Now Moses henceforth received the authorization from God. Now it's very interesting, but this is something which a lot of people don't understand either, and that is that many times God does not give man instruction. He expects man to think into a certain problem and then to consult him. Many times that happened with Moses, and many times in the Torah, where Moses had to go and ask God. And the reason is that God doesn't always put things on a silver platter for man. Now, over here, Moses really made an assumption that he has to be the sole one of giving over the Torah. That's what he thought. He assumed that way. Jethro said, no, it can't be, because that way is not going to be very, it's not going to be very productive. So it must be that God wants you to appoint these people, and that's the way that he expects you to do it, even though he didn't tell you to do that. So he says, that I think that God expects you to do this. So therefore, he says, you can ask God, check with God, and if God authorizes it, then it's okay. But here was a situation where Jethro really figured out what God's intention was to a greater degree than Moses, because we don't maintain that a person, no matter how great they are, we don't say that they're always going to see everything that anybody else will see. Sometimes a great person could be in a dilemma, and a person that's not as great can see the proper idea. When Moses heard the idea, he knew that Jethro was right. And that's why he consulted with God and was done under God's authorization. But without God's authorization, that could not have been done. Okay, later when they set up the Sanhedrin, by the way, Sanhedrin wasn't set up over here. Sanhedrin was set up later, where God, if you remember, was in Numbers, where God instructed Moses to set up the 70. That was done later. But Jethro's idea at Mount Sinai was a similar idea. But his concept was that he realized that it can't be that God intended Moses to be the only one, that he's responsible to give over the Torah himself to everybody, to judge all the people himself.
Okay. Are we ready for the next one?
Yes.
Now this is, I'm going to give a precursor and then the question. It's obvious that there is an oral tradition. Okay? Now, I would say that the oral tradition, the Mishnah, dates back to Rabbi Judah the Prince. He codified it. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right, so that's about 350 of the Common Era.
Right.
All right, so I can say, well, that's good, and I can buy that part. The problem I have is the interpretation of all the various Gemaras that go with that oral tradition. I can read the oral tradition, and it's not a problem. I can understand a lot of it. Maybe not every aspect of it, but a lot of it. But then when I get in, and as you said, you need to be a scholar of Torah or Talmud, but then when, and I'm putting myself first person, so I read there in a section, then I've got 1,500 arguments. Now, these guys, Rabbi Gamliel VI was the last to have Shmicka at Yavner, and he died about 425.
Right.
So now, this is the last part of the question. So we've got all these arguments of the rabbis. Then we've got the rabbis today that are interpreting and telling us what those rabbis said back then. The question is this: which rabbi do we listen to?
Okay,
that's the question.
There are a couple of questions there in that one question.
Right.
Okay. Let me just explain something that I think is very important. You mentioned the Mishnah. You could read the Mishnah. Now, It's true. You may be able to read the Mishnah, and the Mishnah seems very simple. But what all the Talmud does is use logic and reason to analyze the Mishnah. Now, every Talmud scholar knew every single Mishnah by heart. Now, if you read one Mishnah, many times things seem to be correct because a person just doesn't have any knowledge. You know, if you take a person in science and show him one aspect of electricity, he'll say, oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense. But then we show him, well, how come over here it doesn't work that way? Oh, we have problems. Now, a person that sees a Mishnah and doesn't know anything else, oh, it makes perfect sense. But if he would know six other Mishnahs, he'd see there's a contradiction here in 1 second. There are big problems. All right? That's the same thing is true in any science. If you take, in psychology, for example, everybody's a psychologist, because everybody knows a little bit about psychology, but they don't know other things which contradict the premises that they're drawing from the little bit of knowledge they have. So, with a little bit of knowledge, you think things are very smooth. When you gain more knowledge, you find, whoa, there are big problems here. Then you have to have more developed theories. Then once you develop your theories further, then you still see an isolated case, then you have to refine your theory again. The whole idea of Talmud is not really a mysterious concept, that the rabbis are discussing these arguments. It's only mysterious to a person who doesn't know the method and the thinking process and the logical method of analysis of Talmud. Just like science is a big mystery to most people who aren't scientists. I read a book by one of the greatest physicists. He says, the truth of the matter is that only a handful of people in the world really understand physics the way it's supposed to be understood, I mean, by the human mind. Only a handful in every generation. There aren't that many. There are a lot of professors out there, they're repeating things they don't really understand. Now, the same thing is true in Talmud. Instead of saying the oral tradition, I think the right expression would be the oral science of Torah, because that's exactly what it is. Now, a Talmud, you take a look at a little piece of Mishnah, and then you see all this Talmud. Hey, this is very confusing. All the rabbis are doing there is they're analyzing logically what the Mishnah means. Now, this one Mishnah sounds great, but then when you compare it with another one, 1 second, there's a problem there. Oh, it must be this theory. And then they have to continue to work out the theories of the Mishnah. This is no different than any other kind of logical analysis. It's not anything, it's mysterious to a person who doesn't know it, but to a scholar it's not mysterious. A scholar, when he sees the Mishnah, he sees the concept going through the Mishnah, through the Talmud, through the Tosafos, through Maimonides, and he sees the straight line of reasoning. But a person who isn't trained in this kind of a thing just doesn't see it. And he naturally is confused and thinks that, hey, wouldn't it be nice, why don't we just stick with that little Mishnah? What are we getting into all this Talmud for? The answer is, if you want to have a logical analysis, you can't just stick with a few simple things. You have to analyze the whole gamut of the area. You can't just, everything was very simple before they started to fool around with light. Once you start fooling around with light, you have big problems. Your whole physics starts getting into disarray. So if you have little simple things, sure, everything is very nice. But to a scholar who has every word of the Mishnah, of every Mishnah in his mind, when he reads one Mishnah, he knows hundreds of other Mishnahs, for him it's not that simple. Just a second. He puts it through the computer, it doesn't come out right. What do you do with that? What do you do with that? And then he has to show the consistency and the underlying theory, the idea that holds water in all the laws. Because you don't have a proper idea, you can't follow it. It has to be something that makes sense to the human mind. So Talmud is really not mysterious. Talmud is mysterious to a person who hasn't spent years of his life, I mean, day and night in the study until they really understand what's going on there. But when you understand what's going on, it's very clear. I mean, not only is it clear, it's delightful. It's very enjoyable because the ideas are extremely illuminating. A study in Talmud is like an adventure in thought. It's the most beautiful experience that a person can have. But getting back to your second question, the question of who do you follow? The answer to that question is the same answer as any other question. God wants a person to live logically, okay, intelligently. Now, I would ask you, which doctor do you go to? There are many doctors out there. Which doctor do you go to? You go to the doctor that you are convinced your mind tells you is the best doctor. I hope so. I mean, I know a lot of people go to doctors that they're friendly with. And unfortunately, I know many cases where people have lost their lives because of that practice. I mean, they went to a friend, and he wasn't really an expert in the field, and misdiagnosed, and they died. I mean, that's not an intelligent practice. The intelligent practice is to go to the physician that in your mind is the best physician. Okay? Now, Isaiah says that Torah will never cease from the mouths of the children of Israel, which means there will always be Torah scholars. Because if there's no Torah scholars, that's the end of Torah. You know very well, that's it. Once we have no modus operandi in Torah, we're gone. So obviously, when Isaiah made that prophecy, he meant that the Torah will not cease from your mouth or your children's mouth from now until eternity, which means there will always be scholars of Torah in Israel. Now, which scholar do you go to? God wants you to follow your mind. You go to the scholar that you, in your mind, are convinced is the best scholar, is the greatest scholar that you know. Okay? Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you must go to the greatest scholar in the world. Let me get back to Jethro. You're only going to go to one scholar. You can go to a local scholar, provided you sincerely believe that he is an intelligent person, a genuine scholar, an honest scholar, and if he doesn't know something, he will check it out for you in the higher-ups. So you don't have to go. That's the idea of Jethro. You do not have to go to the greatest scholar personally, but you must go to someone that you are convinced is going to give you the correct judgment. He may be a local rabbi, but if you, in your mind, you are convinced this local rabbi is intelligent, what he knows, he tells me. What he doesn't know, he'll check out. He'll ask a higher authority. He'll ask a greater scholar, okay? So that's also fine. You don't have to go every time to the greatest scholar. Now, you can go to somebody that's reliable. But ultimately, it must be a logical plan. That's what God wants man to do. He wants man to be logical and to use reason. So when you choose your scholar, it must be chosen according to your reason and your mind. Now, there can be